Well, against the background of Ian Forster's clock, it's a great pleasure to have a chance to talk to my old friend Osamu Saito. Osamu, when and where were you born?
I was born in 1946. My father evacuated in his Tokyo area simply because it was during the war. He was a medical doctor, had a surgery in downtown Tokyo. But there were the air raids, so that finally he decided to evacuate to the countryside where he was born. I think he went to exactly the same village. He didn't go to exactly the same village, but neighboring some around that village. He settled there, then I was born there.
Let's go back a bit. You're a historian, you know the importance of genealogies. Some people go back hundreds of years, most people go back to their grandparents. Do you know much about your family?
I don't know none of my grandparents. Well, I have four grandparents, but none of them. Simply because my parents, that is the second marriage, and they lost their partners. Each of them lost their partner, and then got married. And then I was virtually the only child of that marriage. So when they got married,
when you say virtually, that suggests there were some others.
There were some others, according to the document. I discovered them. One was born as an infant. That was probably a neonatal death. One was stillbirth, perhaps. So I think my mother had three births, but I was the only one who survived the childhood.
But their parents, i.e. your grandparents, so you had a lot of grandparents because they'd been married before, in a sense, but they'd all died by the time you were...
By the time of my early childhood, yes. They probably, when they got married, they're pretty old already. I think my father was something like 50, my mother about 40. I discovered my family as a sort of a typical pre-modern demographic, having a pre-modern demographic structure. There are a lot of the infant and young age deaths. And I had my brother, who was actually the first son of my father's previous marriage. And he survived his childhood and went to the medical school to just succeed his father's profession. Went into medical school, and then just before completing the MD, PhD, he died.
How was that?
Sort of a leukemia. I discovered this much later. So there are a lot of and my sister-in-law, the eldest, she died of tuberculosis just before the war. So all death and remarriage, all sorts of things are related to the completely sort of typical image of the pre-modern family. So a lot of death and then early childhood, and the remarriage because of the demographic sort of unfortunate demographic events.
Do you think, some psychologist might or psychiatrist might suggest that your interest in demography, pre-modern demography, was related to your own tragic circumstances?
I never thought in that way. One thing, in retrospect, I thought that kind of family background was very influential is that I found, for example, when I went to school, I discovered a lot of differences with others. Well, simply because my parents, or they, for example, came to my parents' evening, they're very different. Mm. My friends' parents are much younger. Mm. So in appearance, what they wore, so all different. My parents are much older than
they were. A previous generation, in a sense.
Yes, yes. At that time, my brother was still alive, mm. and he looked just like my father. You know. Mm. So I became sort of very good at detecting differences.
Mm.
Perhaps that is one of the sort of legacies I got from that rather peculiar family background.
What about other legacies? I mean, what were your parents like as people and their characters? How did that form you?
Unfortunately, my father was already very sickly. Mm. He was a doctor, but at the same time, when I went to secondary school, he was already over 60, and became pretty ill.
Mm.
But my mother was still sort of active, helping his sort of surgery. Mm. So it's a typical self-employed business.
Mm.
My mother was a daughter of a vet doctor in the army. He had already retired before the war. But I think that he was not interested in either sort of science-related profession or the institution like the army. He was probably more interested in something else, like sort of humanities and art and music. And so my mother was really like music.
Mm.
When she was a high school girl, she tried to learn the violin.
Mm.
So she was really a sort of humanities sort of person. My father, yes, my father was a third son of a farmer. So that means in Japan, he is not going to inherit the farm.
Mm.
So he has to go out.
Mm.
So he went to college. First, he went to teacher training college and became a teacher. But for some reason, he never say exactly why, but he decided to quit.
Mm.
Then he took a year off. Came to Tokyo, went to a sort of cramming school just to get into medical school.
Who was paying for the fees for all this?
My guess is that he was very much a sort of planned, had a sort of fixed plan to go to the medical school. So actually he saved his salaries.
Mm.
Because he was a teacher.
The younger son wouldn't get much inheritance from
him. That's right. That's right. His next brother went to University of Kyoto, but the inheriting son never received any higher education. So that was a sort of custom which was quite widespread in the countryside.
You mentioned your mother's interest in music.
Mm.
Did she pass any of this on to you? Are you interested in music?
Oh, yes. Yes, I started developing my sort of interest in music. Well, when I went to secondary school, I started listening some... for example, my mother liked Kreutzer, Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata. So,
You had records?
Yes, yes.
And did you learn to play?
No, I'm very clumsy. So probably my mother wanted me to learn for example, the piano, Mr. Shabbatan. Probably I said no.
You're quite obstinate, right? With your mother. But has music continued to mean a lot to you?
Yes, I do.
You listen to it quite a lot.
Yes. I don't know. One of the reasons why my daughter said she would like to go to music college is a sort of a indirect sort of influence, maybe, from my mother.
She's a musician, yes. I do some people find music relates to their academic work in the sense that either they relax to music when they're, or sometimes they're inspired by a bit of music in their writing. For example, Maitland used to listen to a lot of Wagner and when he was writing. Does music impinge on your creative academic life, do you think, at all?
I'm not quite sure. The kind of music I like is not a sort of exciting me. It's very different. I like, for example, I prefer chamber music to orchestral work or opera or such. So I think the music is very much compatible with sort of concentration on, so for example, reading, or sometimes writing.
Do you listen to music while you're writing or reading?
Sometimes, yes.
You do?
Yes.
Things like, you like things like Bach and Mozart?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And also, I very much like Bartok, which, who's, for example, chamber. The music is very much like the Beethoven and also Bach's chamber music.
What is your earliest memory? Concrete memory, not just sort of the sun shining through the leaves kind of a memory, but something happening to you. Do you remember anything?
Not quite. I remember what others said. about my doing. For example, perhaps I was in the first year of my the school. The when chime rings, we have to go in. But I saw swings are empty now, so I went to the swings. So. Repeatedly, you know, my mother and others told me and others and about that. So probably that is the sort of the experience I had.
You're a rational person, but not listening to authority. Where was your first school?
By that time, my family came back to Tokyo. He had another surgery. That is an area in which a lot of small workshop.
Which part of Tokyo is this?
Ota ward, which is one of the southernmost the ward of Tokyo. There are a lot of, you know, that was in the 1950s, so Japan was very poor still. The small workshop, engineering workshops, they looked very shabby. And since my father was the doctor there, so they came to his surgery. But I don't think definitely that is not a residential area. Middle class people, there are very few. But at the same time, it was really fantastic because there are a lot of empty places still. The legacy of the wartime in the bombing. So there are a lot of spaces we can play. So,
do you remember the feeling of post-bombing to Tokyo? I mean,
yes, in terms of the space, if you go back to the area now, it's a tightly packed area, and a lot of buildings, and factories, workshops. But that time,
flattened.
Yeah, it was just flattened. And there are small spaces here and there. The lot of logs and other things are just a.
It was a nice place for children to play.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Do you remember your first school?
Yes, I do. Again, in the 50s, they were so poor that the ground was just too small, and when I was perhaps in the third year, suddenly a lot of new pupils came and joined us, so that suddenly the ground became very congested. I remember that very well. They have to build a new building, but the short of money, they decided to impose a two-layer sort of timetable. I was told just to come to the afternoon, and the next day then I have to come to school in the morning. So in that way, so it's a sort of shifting system. That started in the when I was the third year. I still remember, you know, that is sort of the post-war baby boomer the cohort. How sort of sudden the change was, I still remember very well.
This must have been, what, about 1953, 4, something like that?
Something like that, yes.
And when you were six
or
seven.
I went to the secondary school in 1958.
So it was a year or two before
55, yes.
Do you remember any teachers at that first school?
Not very well.
Any subjects?
What I remember clearly is the library of that school.
Library?
Yes. How poor it was.
The two books in the library.
Only very few. I quite often went to the library just to borrow books. I bought all the books I wanted to read. The weeks or a month later, I went back to the library to see if there are new, you know, new books. There are probably a few, but those are the books I didn't like to read. So we returned and went back, but still the shelves are just not full. So I remember that very well. That isn't probably when I went to the secondary school, which was private on the fee-paying Keio
school. Keio school?
Yes.
The one set up by Fukuzawa.
That's right.
What is its name?
What we call it Keio Futsubu. It means just an ordinary school, which is really interesting, the name.
How was it that you went to that school? Because it's not... Was it close to where you were living, or quite a long way away?
My brother went to Keio anyway. And also, probably my parents wanted me to go to Keio because that would probably lead to Keio's medical school. And also, for some reason, I did like Keio. Well, partly because my brother was there. And also, probably everybody said that Keio's boys' school is really good.
Was it good?
Yes, it was. It was.
Special in any way? Because it
Well, the difference is the library. It's really fantastic. I remember my primary school's library very well, simply because as a contrast with the Keio's library.
Mm. Were you allowed to use the university library, or was it school?
No, no, it's the boys' school itself has a fantastic library.
Mm.
Although that is just for 12 to 15 years old, so it's a sort of a lower school, but still it has a huge amount of books, not just the books for the boys in that age. You can read, for example, Soseki, Natsume. Not a British version. It's not a sort of a British version for boys. Genuine Natsume, so Soseki, and others. That opened my eyes. I went there.
The Genji and
yes, yeah. Well, I didn't read Genji at that time, but yes. And also friends, people in the same form. They influenced me because some of them are really sort of started developing sort of very much adult-like interests very early. They knew about writers and famous people already. Some of them, you know, have already read one of them or two of them. So intellectually, I received a huge amount of influence from the school and from.
This is between the age of 12 and 15.
Or
did you go at 9?
12.
What happened between 9 and 12? Were you still at primary school?
Yes.
I see.
Yes,
yeah. So it's up from 12 onwards, yeah.
Yes.
Was the school's philosophy, I mean, having been set up by Fukuzawa, did it have any special philosophy?
I don't know. To what extent Fukuzawa did actually exert influence on that. But certainly there was the founder. That is Fukuzawa's disciple. I think he modeled on British public school.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Was it were there borders at it?
No. That is probably the only but important difference. There was that present now. I think there are some boarding schools, but in that period, there aren't many, or probably virtually no boarding schools in Japan. So it's all commuted to school, but some actually commuted from a very far place, the other side.
You got used to being commuter people.
Yes.
Later on, spending half their life commuting. I mean, if he did base it on the British boarding schools of, well, this is at his time, the mid 19th century. Arnold's rugby and so on. One of the big characteristics of those was the emphasis on the physical side of life, and Fukuzawa was interested in the physical samurai spirit and things, which wasn't totally dissimilar from the British public school spirit. That suggests you must have played some games.
It was not compulsory at all. There was a PE, of course, but extra curriculum sport was not compulsory at all. But I did, yes, some. For example, I did some SMO, just wrestling, Japanese style wrestling. Very much
Kendo?
Yes, I did. Well, that is part of my PE. Kendo too, yes.
But it doesn't sound as extreme as British rugby and. Cricket and things like this.
Certainly, that is probably another difference, perhaps.
Yes, it sounds like another difference. Another difference is beating, maybe. I mean, British public schools in the 19th century and right up to the middle of the 20th, a lot of it was based on very punitive behaviour by either the teachers or the prefects towards younger, in which there was a lot of beating. Did that take place?
It never took place, I think, as far as I know. I think the period that already post-war.
Yes.
In the pre-war, period, perhaps. I'm not quite sure, but certainly I think the whole atmosphere very different, I think.
Mm. Because even in the Japanese army, up till the war, there was a lot of physical abuse, as you know. But it changed after the war.
Yes. So I probably benefit of the sort of democratization
of the British boarding school without the bad bits, all the good bits. What subjects did you enjoy at school?
History, some social studies. I didn't enjoy science at all. The good thing is that I didn't need to sit at exams, entrance exams. From that lower school to upper school, there are no exam. From the upper high school to the Keio's university courses, there was no formal exams.
Gosh.
So I really enjoyed without any sort of...
The moving staircase without any obstacles.
Yes.
When you say to the upper school, so you, there was, the lower school was 12 to 15.
Yes.
The upper school, 15 to 18.
That's right. Mm. That's right.
Do you remember, by that time, sometimes there are teachers who have a strong influence on you, and one remembers. Do you remember any?
Yes. At my secondary school, there was a really good history teacher. He taught us for 3 years. I think he was supposed to cover all aspects of history. That means not just the Japanese history, a Chinese history, the Western civilization. But he managed to cover just this tiny bit of Japanese history. starting with the archaeology and end up with the probably 14th century, that's all.
But so the rest of the history was a blank.
He was really fantastic. He gave us all sorts of homeworks, like say, publish your own newspaper, for example.
And you did?
Yes, I did. Everybody likes to... write about battle or and conspiracy, etc., etc. So I was already know a bit about the details of historical events, etc. So I wrote that is the front page, the headline, it's a conspiracy. But they were arrested. So that's sort of the story. It took tremendous days. And I was really absorbed by doing that homework. And I thought I would gain a really good mark for that. But I didn't.
No.
He said just a B. But I turned the page, the back page, I saw A. I didn't spend much time, but I thought that, well, perhaps in the second page there is something about economy, I thought. So the secretary, the minister started trade with China or something like that. This is sort of made up. But I inserted a possible price, a map of a possible price, and it got A.
A. Do you think this is what made you realize economic history was really the kind of history to do?
The teacher told me later that he was a bit concerned my interest in details, especially in political history. So I think he deliberately gave sort of... So differentiate the marks, on the front page and the back page, I think, saying that it's a sort of warning to me.
But you were too interested in minor political details.
At that time, yes.
That's
well, perhaps I was just enjoying reading stories, historical stories, but that's a story, those are stories. But probably he really wanted to say something about that sort of tendency. And history is is something different from storytelling, probably he wanted to say. I realized that much later.
That's interesting. Were there other things that you were enthusiastic about then? I mean, we've mentioned music, but did you have any other hobbies? Did you collect anything? Did you do drama or any other sport or hobby that excited you at that time?
Well, suddenly I like reading. Still, when I went to university, I still very much enjoyed reading stories, novels, and sometimes the poems. But music, but not drama. So one of my children is now in a theater. I don't know why he got interested in theater.
Your children seem to have reacted against you.
Especially boys, yes.
Things that you didn't do. That's interesting.
Oh yes, but my father was fond of kabuki. Yes, I remember that. So when he was all right, he quite often took me to kabuki. He was busy because he was a doctor. So he just chose one act. For example, altogether there are, I don't know exactly how many, four acts in the afternoon or late afternoon. So he just took just one of them and went there and then came back. He always took me with him. So I had no seat. So I just, there was a rating here, like this. So, yes, I don't think I enjoyed them, but yes.
They probably influenced you in some way. One criticism that's made of Japanese schools now, and I've seen in practice, is that they're terribly overstretched. I mean, the children work very long hours and then they go off to evening classes and crammers and their eyes deteriorate and so on. So we in the West, though we're catching this disease, think that this is also true of China and Korea. There's too much stress on form work. Was that true when you were at school, do you think?
No, I don't think so. The merit I received from KO is that I didn't need anything like a rote learning. There are obviously periodical tests, exams, but if you have to sit at the entrance exam, for example, to Todai, the University of Tokyo, you have to memorize a whole lot of things. I didn't need that. So spare time, I just read books. I borrowed a lot from the library. So and also, I still remember when I was in the high school, the upper school, I started doing some. Well, it's not research at all, but sort of research. For example, if I saw some lists of medieval or ancient estates. So I just drew a map and then here and identified the place, the dot. The it took me hours, not just 1 hour, it's 2 hours, and it's even 3 hours. Late in the midnight, I just the filling with the map. So I enjoy really doing such things.
So this is the beginning in a sense of historical, economic, demographic research, filling in maps, places.
Yes. The good thing is that, well, there are teachers in the high school, but I didn't very much sort of enjoy lessons from them. So, but at the same time, I have a lot of spare time. So I just reading all sorts of things.
Did you read I mean, what particularly did you like? Was it Japanese literature, or did you read any non-Japanese?
Yes, I read some non-Japanese literature too, for example, Roman Lawrence, or so I identified him with Beethoven, etc.
But novels, did you read Russian novels, or Dickens, or Western novels?
Yes, I remember I read Karamazov. I think it was
Brothers Karamazov.
I think it was when I was an undergraduate, perhaps, not at high school. Yes, it's a sort of random.
Anything you could.
Yes, find. Random reading. Yes.
Okay, well, let's take you then to Keio University. What did you? You went to read history, did you?
No, I wanted to read history. But there was a sort of fight within the family. My father had already died. He died when I was perhaps 16. So that reduced the pressure from family. Everybody wanted me to go to medical school. Well, I said, no. I want to read history, so I said. But eventually, I started reading some academic books, history books. In the 1950s and even 60s, Japanese history writing was very much influenced by Marxist, the school. So I unconsciously absorbed some Marxian sort of messages that led me to realize economics being important. So eventually I thought perhaps I would go to economics, to read economics. So I went to the Department of Economics. But I would probably read economic history there, but deliberately chose economics rather than history.
Were there any particularly brilliant or outstanding teachers in the economics department?
Well, there was Akira Hayami. That's why I chose him. The quite fortunately, the economic history at Keio was very strong at that time. There are many teachers. There are several who had just come back from the West, having absorbed all sorts of new things. So I really enjoyed various lectures there. I think I made a right choice.
Well, you've mentioned Hayami, and he's going to come up at some point, so he might as well come up now, because I've interviewed him and he's an old friend as well. Tell me something about his influence on your life. And
Japanese universities have a sort of seminar system, although it's called a seminar, but it's actually the German Seminar, which is a sort of class, discussion class, and also some sort of tutorials are provided. So I chose his seminar, meaning that I would write a sort of BA thesis in Japanese economic history. At that time, he had just come back from Europe. There he encountered historical demography, which changed his view of Tokugawa Japan. He just started lecturing based on that sort of idea.
He'd been to France, hadn't he?
He went to Spain, I think.
Did he?
Yes, I think during his stay in Europe, he changed the subject. I think he wanted to do some research on the Japanese-Portuguese relations in the 16th century. But I think he came across population
and
story. Yes, that sort of thing.
And Louis Henry.
Yes, he...
Goubert.
Yes, so he was very much interested in population, the broad population with him. But research itself had just started. Yes, but by the time I went to the graduate school, some of the first results started coming up, coming out, and he came to Cambridge to attend the Household and Family Conference organized by Peter Lasset, and so that is very much a formative period of
he and Peter Lasset worked quite closely.
Yes. That's why I chose Cambridge when I became able to go abroad.
What would you say? I mean, it's a very big subject, but are Hayami's great strengths? I mean, what are his main attributes apart from working fiendishly hard, as I know?
I think he's really good at identify the source for his own sort of research project. The reason why he got interested in population is that probably he had known what population registers were already, and actually his teacher had already started the making use of them. But as soon as he encountered the historical demography there, he suddenly realized, oh, that is really useful. I'd work on
these the household registers, or the
yes. So that sense is really wonderful. That proved quite correct. Probably even richer than he had thought in the 1960s, perhaps. Then eventually he realized how rich the source material is. And then he not just working on population, he started working on family and household. So I think that sense is really fantastic. Perhaps historians ought to have one, two, three abilities. Probably the good historians combine probably two of them. He definitely has that sort of sense.
Sense of the source.
Source, yes.
And what's his second?
Second is hard work. Definitely, yes. that is really time-consuming. Especially, he started the work in the pre-computer age.
Yes.
So how to actually organize his research is very important. It's not just simply, taking note from one from another. He has to have a sort of image of sort of the whole process of manual work. So eventually he come up with a particular card, which is very useful for that manual work. How to classify the cards. It's very simple. Put the red on here, and then for other categories that is purple, blue. And having got a huge table, you just distribute them. He's really good at that.
What do you think he's changed? What are the main sort of new understandings we have of Japanese economic and demographic history as a result of his and his team's work?
By that time, the Marxist interpretations were very strong. The usually the Tokugawa period was painted as a sort of dark age. The peasants are really poor, impoverished, and they had no access to markets. And there are wealthy merchants in Edo and Osaka, but peasants are just not allowed to move. When he started looking at population registers, they quite often go out. Children went to Kyoto in service and came back and married out. And so that showed me, that showed him sort of totally different aspects of village life in Tokugawa Japan. He is not very much interested in sort of market aspects of economic history, but certainly as far as people's movement, migration, and also the population variables. Something that not come to time with the traditional interpretations of Tokugawa economic history. So I think that made him think very seriously about how to rewrite the Tokugawa economic history.
What about, more recently, one of the things he's done is to show the huge variations within Japan between different regions in marriage practices and things like
that. That is another advantage of using population registers, and also that is associated with his sense of using population registers as main source material. The historian tend to work on a particular area, particular village, particular place, particular the region. But he is probably one of the first historians who started using cross-sectionally. As long as he can find the population registers, he go there. So that gives him a sense of sort of geographical variation. That's probably why the other historian tend to be a sort of specialist on particular area, especially in the Tokugawa period. Whole country was divided up into daimyo territories. So if one becomes a sort of specialist in the Shimazu clan, he end up with a Shimazu sort of history. The certainly that has a sort of biased image of the Tokugawa period. And obviously, by reading books and papers by others, and you can correct that bias. But Hayami can have a sort of first-hand observation.
Do you think, you mentioned the specialization by region. Do you think there's, and you know Western historians, do you think there's any sort of tendency among Japanese historians to be more concentrated on small sub-areas of the discipline and to become absolute perfectionists and know everything? In other words, there's more specialization, less willingness to generalize or to work more broadly. Do you think that is a difference between much Japanese history and Western history or not?
Yes, certainly. I think that is one of the differences, yes. The reason, I don't know. There are probably several reasons. One is the Tokugawa Japan itself was divided up already. So the source are divided up. So that is probably one reason. And also, in the modern period too, that is rather curious, but we don't have a good national archive. For example, censuses. The first censuses, the original returns, they're destroyed. So we have no way to make use of our...
Was this because of the war, or they just weren't interested to keep them?
That's a combination of the war because they have to, they had to move the archives in the countryside. But also, still, I can detect also a tendency for civil servants to destroy the originals. They don't like the original, perhaps.
Also, the political structure of Japan, as you say, is much more regional. The shogun was powerful, but it wasn't a very centralized system administratively or paper-wise. So something like the Public Record Office in London, which has these huge archives of administrative and particularly legal papers, you wouldn't necessarily find that in Japan. You would find them in the different daimyo areas. Is there a national archives now?
Yes, there is, but still national archives sometimes are much smaller than other archives. That's really a pity.
But it's to do with the history of the Japan.
And also, I think in history we have had two strong influences from the West. One is from von Ranke, the other is from Marx. They're totally different influences.
Ranke's is the influence on narrative and
and details.
Political.
Yeah, and especially details. I think source criticism, and also the emphasis on sort of details. I think the way the Japanese historian received the lessons from Ranke was probably different from historians in the West, perhaps. But I think the tendency was historians in the history department, in the Faculty of Letters, most of them think that details are very important. And the relationship between the facts, detailed facts, with the source, as almost essentially important. So that is what attitude they developed. On the other hand, they have no way to interpret their findings. So then came the Marxian influence. The Marxian school gave them sort of jargons and big pictures. So some of them, although trained in traditional history, they absorbed Marxian frameworks. So there are two, but in between, we didn't have much sort of midway sort of in the path.
You didn't have anything equivalent, for example, of what was discussed a lot in Cambridge, which is Whig history, sort of imperial later 19th century ideas of evolution and progress, which gave you a framework for interpreting your facts. It was all part of a great national story and the movement of history forwards from our Anglo-Saxon ancestors. You didn't really have that in Japan.
No, in the professional world, no. But I think what Fukuzawa left was probably something like that. Yes, but unfortunately, that was not taken up by professional historians.
Because he had a four or sometimes five period evolutionary theory about how things evolve through time.
Yes.
But that's interesting. So his influence was in politics and elsewhere in education, but not in history.
Not in history.
That's interesting. Okay, well, let's go on to your own, a little more on your own life. You did your BA in economics. And then what happened?
And then I went to graduate school. Then I finished 2 years for MA. And then...
What was your subject of your
MA? Economic history, Japanese economic history.
In particular?
I started working with Meiji data. Early Meiji. So that, I think in retrospect, that was really the crucial period, I thought, because it was not modern enough. It's very close to the Tokugawa. I think that later made me sort of easier to sort of come across, I mean, go over this sort of boundary between Tokugawa and Meiji. Many historians actually stop at the end of the Tokugawa period. They never go beyond that. The Meiji should never go back into the Tokugawa because sources are different. But I started with the early Meiji data. So that I think that I made again rather the good choice.
And what was the theme?
Migration, regional labor market, that sort of thing. I started with work, labor, movement. You could say that these are related to the labor market research, but at the same time, that could lead you to household and family studies. At that time, I didn't know in what direction that the research would lead me. But I started.
And that went on into your MA as
Yes,
well.
Yes.
Same theme.
Yes. With MA, I was chosen as a. It's called. Assistant, but actually it's a German assistante. I got tenure already there. Just like young scholars in English colleges.
So you got tenure very young?
Yes.
At 24. At KO?
Yes, 24.
Very young.
Although it was called assistant, I don't need to give assistance to others. The only thing is that Hayami had the class or seminar. So I look after his students.
You assisted Hayami. I mean, one of the things that strikes a Western academic about Japanese education is this very strong ie system within it, the sensei system, that a teacher, a distinguished teacher like Hayami, will quite early on in their career think of who their successor is going to be, and they pick out someone, and Maruyama did this, and so on. At what point did you realize that you were Hayami's successor?
Well, when they chose me at 24. I thought everyone would think that I'm the successor to Hayami. So I try not to work on population, I thought, at that time, when I was in the 20s. So I thought I would continue to work on more economic history, sort of the themes, rather than demographic themes.
So distance yourself.
Yeah, I try to distance myself, you know, with Hayami. That sort of sense is still very strong. Yes.
And do you have a successor?
Well, because I moved. The university. Yes. I didn't have a successor in KO, at KO.
Yeah. But you have at Hitotsubashi.
Hitotsubashi. Curiously, I became a research professor at the institute, not at the faculty. So I have no successor. There is no way to have a successor at the institute because that is 100% research oriented.
I see.
But if I were a professor at the economics department or history department,
than you would have.
Mm.
What I mean, I was amazed at the kind of the strength of this relationship, because your professor becomes, you know, the person who arranges your marriage traditionally, and you go and look after them in their old age, and they find you a job, and so on and so on. Is that still quite strong in Japanese academic life?
Well, one thing I'm really grateful to Akira Hayami is that he was not the sort of kind of person.
He wanted you to go and look after his garden, or cook
he himself, you know, have a lot of, you know, ideas, a lot of, you know, things to do, and he has no time to look after, you know, his students. So suddenly he didn't make any arrangement, you know, marriage arrangement for his students. And also, I got an offer from Hitotsubashi. Before his retirement at Hitotsubashi, well before his retirement, so it is I who decided to go.
Was he upset about that you left, or?
Or upset his colleagues. Everybody thought that I would go on and
as his successor.
Yes, but it came out of the blue. Because even the scholars, an economic historian outside Keio, thought that we would never move. Especially, I was brought up in Keio from
childhood.
Yeah, childhood. Yes. So. Nobody probably thought that I would ever move, but those at Hitotsubashi thought that and I would be interested in coming to Hitotsubashi. I think primarily because that is a research institute. Suddenly I had no undergraduate there, and the 100%
research,
and also there are a lot of research students. That's good, because we can form a team or doing research, you know, together. I moved to Hitotsubashi 1982. I think I was 30. I can't remember exactly how old I was.
Yes. Something. Were you married by then?
Yes, of course. Yes, I came to Cambridge in the 70s anyway, and with Nobuko, and also my son was 2 to 3 at that time. So yes, I have already my family. So I moved to Hitotsubashi. I think I was something like 38. The reason, psychological reason, why I accepted the offer is quite simple. I had undergraduate classes, lectures, and also by that time I had spent a huge amount of time on administration, university duties, etc., etc. Became quite busy. I felt a sort of fed up with the, and also still I was very young, probably too young to be able to combine different things together and compartmentalize one thing and moving on to another thing. I couldn't do that, perhaps. So I thought the research institute is a sort of paradise. So I said yes. That certainly upset my colleagues. But surprisingly, not Akira Hayami. He was not sort of a person. So I'm really grateful to him saying anything about my move. as a sort of irresponsible, being irresponsible and
ungrateful.
So I made my decision on my own. I still remember when I telephoned him after having a telephone call from the Hitotsubashi Institute. He just listened and said, "Okay, when you made a decision, just let me know. That's all."
Very good.
Yeah.
Philosophical. I mean, taking back one step back, you mentioned you came to Cambridge in the 70s.
Yes.
Was that to work with the Cambridge group?
Yes. I got the scholarship from the Fukuzawa Memorial Fund. I could have choose any country, United States or France or Britain. Akira Hayami, at one point, he said that, what about France, he said. At that time, another school is really powerful, very influential. Certainly, I had read some of the another school publications, obviously in English, not in France, French. But that was the reason was quite simple. I couldn't read French. So
or speak it.
I chose Cambridge. Quite fortunately, Akira Hayami knew Peter Lassett already. I came to the Cambridge group.
Tell me about Peter Lassett.
Well, that is another sort of fortune, I came across in my life. Peter asks question a lot. And every time I meet him, he questions. Some of them are totally irrelevant. But two-thirds about Japan. Some of them are really, out of the mark sort of question. But still, he made me think. So irrelevant question made me think very seriously. Leading me to sort of topic or the connections which I never thought of. So I really like to meet him. And also I started working on unexpectedly on English materials there. The reason again, Peter, one of the very early sort of meetings, I think, I told him about my sort of very general idea. As I said, I had been working on work, labor, occupation, that sort of thing. Perhaps my idea could be done with the English material as without much, specific plan. I just probably told him about my idea. He said, "Just do it." So I went to the library and they went over the listings. By that time, I think they had already collected some 500. So I went over all the 500 listings and chose only two. With which I could do the plan I had in mind. So I started working on it. And Peter was very pleased. He kept asking me about my progress. And then also that made me sort of think about how individual sort of level information is tied up with some other big pictures. That is the way in which Cambridge Group, House and the Family, the research has been doing. They are working on very small things, but at the same time, they always have the broad pictures, broad stories, and broad hypotheses on the come and go, you know, between the two. I'm really learned a lot from my experience with the English materials at the Cambridge Group.
The other person, well, there were several other people there, but particularly Tony Rickley, did you get to know him well?
Yes, from that period on, yes, we have been very close. But at the same time, during my stay at the Cambridge Group in the 70s, I was working on an occupation, the work. So at that time, I was not particularly interested in demography. I really don't know why I started working on demography at the end of my, eventually. But suddenly I started working on demography in Japan rather than in Cambridge. But thanks to my some knowledge about what the Cambridge Group has been doing, it was quite easy for me to get on with historical demography. Obviously, because Akira Hayami was there. So I eventually came to work on both economic history and historical demography. And Roger and Tony, not just Tony and Roger, and also there was Jim Oppen and
Richard Walls. What, I mean, it's a very broad question, but you worked on English materials and on Japanese materials. If you had to pick out three or four of the major either similarities or differences between what you found in these two places in the period you were studying, what would you single out as similarities and differences?
Differences are quite, I think, straightforward, I thought. When I started working on English materials, I could see how the family looked like. So definitely there are sort of small nuclear families. Whereas when I look at the Shimura Tamicho population registers, there are sometimes more complex family households. That is obvious sort of difference. But at the same time, the difference in the family structure, family and household structure, must have been related to some other differences. I thought, the way in which I was working on work and labor. Labor was supplied, for example. The labor supply is a very much abstract word in economics, but in the Tokugawa period, that meant in many cases the children were sent into service. See how they were sent into service and how they came back home. So these are sort of probably within the particular mode of household formation and family household structure. So those things I learned a lot from my Cambridge experience.
You had servants in both places.
Yes, yes.
Which is unusual. You don't get the servant phenomenon except in these two places.
But, yes.
But you get more return to the household in the Japanese case, in the English case, once you've left home, you tend not to go back. Is that a big difference?
That is true, yes, that is true. Especially girls went back just to, for example, get married. But I think the more fundamental difference is that after getting married, they became self-employed, whereas in England, they became agricultural laborers in most cases. So they do not go back to the very different self-employed household economy.
So in the Japanese case, the girls came back, but then they set up as self-employed as part of the household economy.
That's right. Men too. Men's experience are probably more diversified. Some of them came back just to be adopted by others.
This again is a huge difference, the system of adoption.
That's right. That is another difference.
Which you don't get in England.
I think for boys in the early 20s, perhaps in the high teens, adoption was a very much a good sort of job opportunity for them. One of the most, probably most important job opportunities for non-inheriting sons. The obviously one option is just to go to the city, train there, or apprentice there, and then become a carpenter and etc. But probably far more important is the adoption, I think. I looked at some demographic parameters and suggesting that there is a big opportunity for them. Some of them came back simply because to be adopted. So they found a job there.
It was traditional in England, if you were a servant and you were for hire, that you would put a straw in your mouth and stand on the on certain days on the edge of the square, and people would come and hire you for a year. When you wanted to be adopted, could you wear a certain kind of hat or put up a notice saying for adoption or what?
I think it's something like arranged marriage.
There were people who, professional arrangers of adoptions, were there?
I don't think there are the genuine professional go between them. Probably there are just the key persons within a sort of kin network or social network. They know a lot of people here and there. Not just the people in the same village, some neighboring village as well. They are connected, related to some other families. So they know there are some young second and third sons, you know. Here they are only daughters, you know. So there are simply connections. I think always there are that sort of person.
What this creates is an adoption by bringing someone in and turning them into a family member creates loyalty and commitment to the family firm. But it combines that, it's very like a Cambridge College, it combines commitment and loyalty with supposedly achievement and effectiveness. It's artificially recruited, and yet it has the emotional overtones of something that is based on birth and blood, which is very powerful as a way of organizing a society. Because if you go too much towards blood, then it becomes very static and structured, and you get bad heirs. You go towards total market penetration, then you have no commitment. But this Japanese method gives you a very good combination.
Yes, it gives the Japanese system some sort of a flexibility, yes. There are some anecdotal evidence that in big merchant houses, they deliberately adopt from one of the servants, despite sometimes they had sons. They get their daughter married to one of the bright servants. Although that number is very small, but certainly that tells you how these things worked. And when I was looking at the population registers, I came across several divorce cases, and all took place with inheriting daughters. So all related to the adoption, actually. The man adopted, turned away next year. Then next year, you know, they adopted another, but again turned away. So the succession of divorce was recorded there. I think that is something related to what you described now.
It's also, to us, a strange phenomenon in Japanese novels that the mother-in-law can just tell her daughter or her son, I don't like your partner, you must get rid of them and bring in another one. To us, this would be unacceptable and, of course, impossible with a Christian church. But in Japan, it's the parents. If the parents think that the marriage is not suitable, they can break it up.
Although we can't tell that it is really mother or mother-in-law who actually says so. Or sometimes the daughter herself maybe, you know, simply didn't like the man who was chosen by parents. I don't know. I mean, we don't really don't know. But certainly the record says that that sort of thing could happen. In Japanese household.
If someone asked you, in other words, if I asked you what you thought were the two or three ideas that you had contributed to historical research which you're most excited about and feel are your most important, interesting ideas, what would they be?
Well, I don't know.
Well, things that you really remember with pleasure, having discovered something that surprised and shocked you.
Perhaps I'm somewhat good at relating things in economic history to the study of household and the family and demography, and vice versa. And also the placing some Japanese findings in a sort of comparative perspective in comparison with Western Europe. And also I can easily apply that sort of methodology to China. At least I have no sort of psychological sort of the difficulty in doing that kind of comparative work.
What has come out of that? I mean, what particular one or two particular findings that surprised you about, say, the similarities and differences in China and Japan or the Western Japan?
This is simply because I have just finished my lectures here. Since the publication of Ken Pomerantz's The Great Divergence, I have been thinking over the argument that he made in the book. His argument is that East Asian living standards in the 18th century was very much comparable to the living standards in the West. And I have now I'm now sort of convinced that if we look at household income, it's not the real wages, not just real wages, and household income of the sort of bottom group, like the peasant in Japan, in Tokugawa Japan or in Imperial China, compared with the agricultural laborer in England, I think he's right. The living standards of those people are very much comparable with each other. But if you compare just real wages, as Bob Allen and others said, they're very different. England was a high wage economy, whereas Japan was a low wage economy. Why that is possible? That is some I sort of can tell. And Japan has a very different sort of mode of household economy, so that the household economy is a sort of place in which various economic activities are actually combined within the same household. The by employment gives you some idea that it is because they were so poor that they were forced to take up some low pay by employment. But actually, it is simply because they are flexible, and also they have some idea of planning. So how to plan the whole calendar, they have already developed that sort of notion. So in that way, perhaps we can explain why that there are a gap between living standards measured by, for example, wages, and measured by household income, which is a mixed income. So that is one of the conclusions I reached recently.
How does Pomerantz's work differ, in that respect, differ from Susan Hanley's work, where she also argues that the living standards of Japanese are about the same as those in Western countries?
Well, her idea of living standards much broader. In order to say, even a similar statement, she ought to brought the various aspects like hygiene in Tokyo or in Edo or some environmental sort of aspects and the disease. But I don't need these things. I can add on, but I can stick to economic measures. But still, I think the more important thing is the sort of difference in the ways in which economy was at work.
If someone said, well, it may be the case that if you take English labourers and compare them with farm workers or the lowest level of Japanese rural workers, there's quite a lot of similarity. If, on the other hand, you take into account that most of English wealth was not at the level of labourers, the next level up, in other words, small yeomen, farmers, artisans, and that the peculiarity of the English social structure is that most people were above the, or a lot of people were above the level of labourer. So you have a large lower middle, a middle and upper middle class who live in good houses, eat meat every day, have good clothes, send their children to school, sometimes literate, and that is very different from Japan.
It is. It is. The in my lecture, I simply gave that aspect too. Although if you look at the bottom, they look very much similar in terms of economic concept of living standards. But if you go up, there are huge difference. And you have a much thicker middle class people. And their average household income is much wealthier, I mean much larger. So that the whole domestic market was much larger in England than in Japan. So that this is the third measure, that is, if you can calculate sort of per capita GDP, which is much larger, which is much higher than in Japan in the Tokugawa period. It's a bit ironical because that is to say that in England, high income inequality and the economic growth were interrelated. That actually implies that in Japan, because of the smallness of the middle classes, Japan was a low growth economy during the Tokugawa period.
Because of the disposable income for most people was very small.
Yes, the market was small. As Adam Smith said, the division of labor was limited by the extent of the market, which is the domestic market. I think I can explain within exactly the same framework that the if you look at the bottom, the Japanese living standards are comparable to the Western laborers. But at the same time, within the same work, I can explain why the growth rates are so different between England and Japan. Probably that is an aspect Susan Handley didn't have in her argument.
Because Pomerantz's argument is that the having been more or less the same up till about 1800, the difference was therefore not attributable to anything particular about Western economy or anything. It was the two chance events of the overseas empire and the development of coal. What do you think of that argument?
Well, perhaps what I can say is about that debate on the Great Diversions is that although if you look at this, the quantitative measures of living standards, there are some similarities. And at the same time, if you look at the income inequality, there are some differences. But if you look at deeper, that is the sort of structural aspects, we have definitely a divergence, which took place much earlier. The statement that England was a high wage economy means it's not simply saying that England had a higher living standards. It ought to be a high wage economy because so much is depending on hired labor. So labor ought to be supplied. So the whole household economy ought to be geared to the supplying labor. So that was long time ago. They gave up, having a sort of family farm already. So that took place much earlier. So we think this sort of divergence took place probably in the middle medieval period or very early early modern period. I think that is the real sort of structural divergence, especially between the Japan and probably the economy of the lower Yangtze, perhaps, is very similar to the one that we in Japanese, Tokyo Japanese economy. That took place much earlier. So that is my sort of feeling.
And another structural possible divergence is in the amount of non-human energy available in the society. In England, by the middle of the 18th century, or the end of the 18th century, certainly, you have a huge consumption of non-human energy in the form of wood, coal particularly, lime, etc., but also a huge amount of wind power, water power, and above all, animal power. So for every labourer working in the fields, he has two or three invisible labourers working alongside him. Now in Japan, you don't have that. You don't have animals, you don't have wind power, water power much. And as a result, people have to work much, much harder.
Yes, that's right. So I think there is a connection between the high-wage economy and the greater reliance on non-human energy. Because that is a way in which labor productivity is enhanced. Whereas in Japan, since it was a low-wage economy, there is no need to make that connection. But at the same time, what was very higher in Japan is that land productivity. The land productivity ought to be sort of the key, the cornerstone of the whole economy. already by the end of the Tokugawa period, perhaps the per hectare productivity was already higher than some of the levels found in the post-war Asian rice-growing economies. So if you have got, for example, 1 hectare paddy field, you can actually calculate how many the feed. They have sort of a notion, 1 hectare is enough? Yes, they would say. So land productivity is really important. So to achieve a very high level of land productivity, you ought to combine various productive activities. So it ought to be by employing people, not just planting rice, but also you need a sort of second crop. And also sometimes they brought in cash crop as well. They started sowing within the rows of the winter crops. They started already sowing. So in that way, the level of utilization of land ought to be increased. That is a sort of process that Japan saw over the, not just a century, it's 2 centuries, 3 centuries, or even longer.
One sort of last question around this field. One of the inspiring ideas I got from your teacher, Hayami, was his famous contrast between an industrious revolution, which he characterized Japan as having an industrious revolution, and Britain and some of the West having an industrial revolution. Do you think that contrast is still valuable?
Oh, yes. There is certainly a contrast in that sort of area. But what I have a sort of a quibble is that the term revolution. I don't think there was a revolution during the Tokugawa period.
Already,
Japanese were industrious at the beginning of the Tokugawa period, already on the track of the very labor-intensive agriculture, labor-intensive economic activity. So it's simply moving along that line.
Well, of course, Nick Crafts and others would say they would have the same quibble about Western Industrial Revolution. There wasn't one. It was there already.
Already, yes.
In this case, it was more of an evolution than a revolution. Well, we've covered a number of things. There are always many more things in a person's life that one can talk about in an hour or so. But is there anything that you would really like me to ask you about?
No, I think it was fine.
We've covered everything.
Well, as long as they would be interested in what I said.
It was lovely. And thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed.
For talking.